inside was large as the bedroom in the Imperial Quarters, which made this single room larger than the apartments Cardenia grew up in. The room was bare, except for a single bench that jutted out from the wall to her left. Cardenia went and sat on it. "I'm here," she said, to no one in particular. A figure of light appeared in the center of the room and walked toward her. Cardenia looked up as the figure approached. Micro-projectors in the ceiling were creating the image walking over to her now. Cardenia idly wondered at the physics behind it, but only for a second, because now the image was directly in front of her.
"Emperor Greyland II," it said, and bowed.
"You know who I am," Cardenia said, skipping the Imperial we.
"Yes," the image said.
It had no identifiable signs of gender or age.
"I am Zhiyi. You are in the memory room. Please tell me how I may assist you."
Cardenia knew why she was there, but hesitated. "Does anyone other than the Emperor come in here?"
"No,"
Zhiyi said. "What if I invite someone?"
"Focused light and sound waves would make it unbearable for anyone other than the reigning Emperor to come through the door."
"Can't I override that?"
"No."
"I am the Emperor. And I am arguing with a machine," Cardenia thought, but did not say.
"The injunction was made by the Prophet,"
Zhiyi said,
"whose order is inviolable."
This took Cardenia back. "This room dates to the reign of the first Emperor," she said.
"Yes."
Xion didn't exist then.
"The room was moved from Hubfall, with other elements of the palace, when Xion was founded. The rest of the palace was built around it."
The image of the space station of Xion being built around the Imperial Palace popped into Cardenia's mind, so absurd as to be almost comical. "So you are 1,000 years old, she said to Zhiyi.
"The information I store dates back to the founding of the interdependency," Zhiyi said. "The physical machinery it is stored on is regularly updated, as are the functional elements of this room and the manifestation you see in front of you."
"I thought you said no one may enter this room but the Emperor."
"Automated maintenance, ma'am,"
Zhiyi said, and Cardenia thought she heard just the slightest edge of humor in the voice, which made her first feel a bit stupid and then curious.
"Are you alive, Zhiyi?"
she asked.
"No,"
Zhiyi said.
"Nothing you encounter in this room is alive. Excepting you, ma'am."
"Of course," Cardenia said, only a little disappointed.
"I sense we may have carried this specific conversation to an end," Zhiyi said. "May I assist you otherwise?"
"Yes," Cardenia said. "I would like to speak to my father." Zhiyi nodded and faded out. As it did so, another form coalesced in the center of the room. It was Cardenia's father, Batrin, lately Emperor Ottavio VI. He appeared, looked toward his daughter, smiled, and walked over to her. The memory room was established by the Prophet Emperor Raikela I not long after the foundation of the interdependency and her ascendance as its first emperor. Each emperor was fitted with a personal network of sensors running through their body that captured not only every sight seen and every sound heard or spoken by the emperor, but every other sensation, action, emotion, thought, and desire apprehended or produced by them as well. Within the memory room were the thoughts and memories of every emperor of the interdependency, dating back to the very first, the Prophet Emperor Raikela I herself. If Cardenia wanted, she could ask any one of her predecessors any question about them, about their reign, about their time. They would answer from memory, from the thoughts and recordings and the computer modeling of who they were, girded on decades of every single thing about their internal lives recorded for this very room. There was only one destination for this information, the memory room. There was only one audience for it, the current emperor. Cardenia subconsciously touched the back of her neck again, in the place where the network seed was implanted, to grow inside her. One day, everything I do as Emperor will be in here, she thought, for my own child and their children to see. Every Emperor will know who I was, better than history will. She looked at the apparition of her father, now directly in front of her, and shuddered. The apparition noticed. Are you not happy to see me? It asked. I saw you just a few hours ago, Cardenia said, standing up from the bench and looking over the apparition of her father. It was perfect, almost touchable. Cardenia did not touch it. You were dead then. I still am, Ottavio VI said. The consciousness that was me is gone. Everything else was stored. So you're not conscious now? I'm not, but I can respond to you as if I were. You may ask me anything. I will tell you. What do you think of me? Cardenia asked, blurting it out. I always thought you were a nice young lady, Ottavio VI said. Smart, attentive to me. I don't think you'll make a very good emperor. Why not? Because right now the interdependency has no need of a nice emperor. It never does, but it can tolerate one when nothing consequential is going on. This is not one of those times. I wasn't particularly nice to the executive committee today, Cardenia said, hearing how defensive the word sounded coming out of her mouth. I'm sure that in the wake of my death, for your very first meeting with them, the executive committee made a fine show of being restrained and deferential. Also, they are seeing at what length of chain you're most comfortable, in order for them to get every single thing they want from you. They'll yank on that chain presently. I'm not sure I like this entirely honest you, Cardenia said after a moment. If you like, we can adjust my conversational model to be more like I was in life. You're telling me you lied to me in life. No more than to anyone else. That's comforting. In life, I was human, with an ego, just like anyone else. I had my own desires and intentions. Here, I am nothing but memory, here for the purpose of assisting you, the current emperor. I have no ego to flatter, and will flatter yours only if ordered to. I would not suggest it. It makes me less useful. Did you love me? It depends on what you mean by love. That sounds like an evasive, ego-filled answer. I was fond of you. You were also inconvenient until the moment you were needed for succession. When you became the crown princess, I was relieved you didn't hate me. You couldn't have been blamed if you had. When you died, you said you wished you had had time to love me better. Ottavio VI nodded. That sounds like something I would say. I imagine I meant it in the moment. You don't remember it. Not yet. My final moments have not yet been uploaded. Cardenia dropped the subject. I chose the imperial name of Greyland II, as you suggested. Yes, that information, at least, is in our database. And good. I read up on her. Yes, I had planned to ask you to. You did, before you died. Why did you ask me to name myself for her? Because I hoped it would inspire you to take seriously what's coming next and what it would require from you, Ottavio VI said. Do you know about the Count of Clermont on End? I do, Cardenia said. An old lover of yours. Ottavio VI smiled. No, not at all. A friend. A very good friend. And a scientist. One who brought me information that no one else had, and that no one else would have wanted to see. One who needed to do his work and research insulated from the stupidities of court and government, and even of the community of scientists in the interdependency. He's someone who has been collecting data for more than 30 years now. He knows more about what's coming next than anyone else. A thing you must be prepared for. A thing you are not in the least prepared for now. And a thing I worry that you will not be strong enough to see through. Cardenia stared at the apparition of Ottavio VI, which stood there, a small, pleasant, distracted smile on its face. Well, Cardenia said, finally, what is it?
Chapter 4.
Who here knows what the interdependency is? Marse Claremont asked from the well of the planetarium. From the chairs of the planetarium, the hands of several eight-year-olds shot upward. Marse scanned the hands, looking for the one who seemed to most urgently need to answer the question. He picked a hand sitting in the second arc of chairs. Yes, you.
I have to go to the bathroom,
the child said. Behind the child, Marse saw one of the adult chaperones roll her eyes, get up, grab the child by the hand, and start walking him to the bathrooms. Then he picked another kid.
It's the nation of systems we all live in, said the girl.
That's right, Marse said, and pressed a button on his tablet to dim the lights and start his presentation. It's the nation of systems in which we live. But what does that really mean? Before he could continue, the planetarium rocked slightly as what sounded like two interceptors buzzed the university science center the planetarium was part of. The children started at the noise, the chaperones trying to hush them and telling them everything would be all right. Marse doubted everything was actually going to be all right. The University of Opole, which housed the science center, was far from the capital and the focus of the fighting. But in the last week, things had taken a decisive turn against the Duke and his loyalist forces, and now even the far provinces had sprouted rebels and the violence that came with revolution. He'd been surprised when this bus full of children had showed up at the science center today. He had assumed that all the schools had canceled their classes like the university had. Then he saw the look on the faces of the adults who had brought the children. They appeared grimly determined to give the kids as commonplace an experience as they could, for as long as they could. Marse, who was, in point of fact, the only member of the non-janitorial staff to show up on this particular morning, and then only to collect some materials that were not already on the network, didn't dare let them down. He brought them all down to the planetarium and dug into his brain to remember the standard presentation about the interdependency that the tour docents usually gave. It's all right, he said to the children. Those aircraft were just passing by. We're just on their flight path, that's all. The university is safe. This was also probably not true, since the University of Opole had more than its share of rebel sympathizers, ranging from stoned students looking for a movement to join to reflexively contrarian professors who enjoyed sticking it to the Duke while still retaining tenure. Most of them, students and faculty, were probably down in a cellar at the moment. Marse, who was personally resolutely apolitical, for all the good it did him, did not blame them at all. Be that as it may, there was no point panicking eight-year-olds about the possibility of the university being occupied either by rebels or by the Duke's troops. Right now, Marse's job was keeping them distracted. Today might be the last relatively normal day they'd have for a while. Might as well make the most of it. Marse touched his tablet again, and a star field leapt out of the projector into the empty space above the well of the planetarium, accompanied by soothing, tinkling music. The eight-year-olds, apprehensive just 5 seconds earlier, oohed and awed at the sight. So did the adults. What you're seeing now are all the stars that exist in the area that holds the interdependency, Marse said. From hub to end, all of the stars we live around are here. Does anyone want to guess which one we are? The children shot out their fingers, all at entirely different points of light. From his tablet, Marse tapped on one of the stars. The projected image zoomed in toward a single star, and when it stopped, showed a solar system of 5 planets. 2 terrestrial, 3 gas giants. This is us, he said. The 2nd planet out from our sun. This is End. Called that because it's located as far away from anything else in the interdependency as you can go. Marse pulled back out into the full star field. Now, all of these stars are in the space the interdependency claims for its own, but not all of them have systems that humans can live in. In fact, of these more than 5,000 star systems, only 47 of them have humans in them. He made the star systems of the interdependency glow more brightly so the children could see them. The systems were not generally close to each other in space. They seemed randomly distributed. diamonds among grains of sand.
Why are they all so far apart?
Asked one of the children, rather conveniently for the purposes of the next part of the standard presentation.
Excellent question,
Mars said. Now, you might think that all the human systems would be huddled close together, so they would be easy to travel to. But all the systems are connected not in space, but by the flow. A bunch of lines arched out of the human systems, connecting them to each other's system, prompting another set of appreciative coos from the children. The flow is like a super shortcut through space, Marsh said. Normally, it would take years or even centuries for humans to get from one star system to the next. Even the closest systems are a few light years away from each other, and using regular drives, even that relatively short distance would take 20 or 30 years for us to cross. Even our most advanced starships, called Tenors, can't make that trip. With the flow, we can travel between systems in weeks or months at most. But here's the catch. We can only travel to the systems where the flow is nearby. He zoomed into another system, this one with 10 planets, and zoomed in further. Does anyone know which planet this is? There was no answer. This is called Hub, and it's the capital of the interdependency. Does anyone want to guess why?
Because that's where the Emperor lives?
Well, yes, but the Emperor lives there for a reason, and the reason is this. Mars tapped his tablet, and the planet of Hub was surrounded by what looked like a whirlpool of lines, swirling in the space above the world. Hub is the one place in the interdependency where all the flow streams converge. It's the only place you can get directly from and to nearly every system in the interdependency. That makes it the most important planet for trade and travel. If we couldn't travel through Hub, some systems in the interdependency would be years away from each other. That's why the planet is called Hub. It's the center of our universe, so to speak.
Can't we just make a path in the flow between planets?
This question was from one of the adults, who apparently had gotten so sucked into the presentation that he forgot question time was for the children. We'd like to, but we can't, Marsh said, answering anyway. The flow isn't something that we control. And really, if we're honest with ourselves, it's something that we don't understand very well. It's like a natural feature of the universe. We can access it, but we can't really do anything with it but go where it's going anyway. In fact, that makes for one of the really unusual features about the interdependency. Mars zoomed out, wiped the starfield, and put up a grid of the 47 systems of the interdependency. The systems featured stars ranging from red dwarfs to sun-like yellow stars, harboring anywhere between one and a dozen major planets. The images of the systems were not to scale and showed the planets zooming along in their orbits, some so quickly it was comical. A few of the children laughed. Humans live in all of these star systems, but the planets in most of these star systems aren't the kinds that are good for human life. Mars zoomed into Hub again. Hub, for example, is airless and tidally locked. That means one side of the planet is always facing the sun, so it's super hot, and the other side is facing away, which makes it frozen. Humans on Hub have to live under the ground to survive. He zoomed out and picked another system. Here, in the Morobe system, the only planets are gas giants, huge planets that don't even have a surface to land on. We couldn't live on those. These planets have moons, but most of them aren't very suitable for humans either. So here, we live in space habitats, positioned in spots called Lagrange points, or in other places that can be made stable. So that's how most humans live now. Underground on rocky planets, or on large space habitats. There's only one place in the interdependency where humans live on the surface of the planet. Mars zoomed out and in again, back to end, which hovered on the screen, a blue-green marble clouded in white. That's us. That's End.
What about Earth?
One of the children asked, as one of them always did.
Good question,
Mars said. Earth is where humans originally come from. And, like on End, you could walk around on its surface. But the Earth isn't part of the interdependency. We lost contact with the Earth over 1,000 years ago when the single flow stream to it disappeared.
How did that happen?
It was the adult again, who was immediately shushed by one of the other adults. Marsh smiled at this. It's complicated, he said. The best non-technical answer I can give you is that everything in the universe is constantly moving, including star systems, and that movement sometimes affects the flow. Basically, the Earth moved, we moved, and the flow stream went away.
Can it happen again?
Bint! Someone said to the adult asking questions, admonishing him.
Look, I want to know, Bint said.
It's all right, Marsh said, holding up a hand. In fact, it did happen again, more than 700 years ago, when we lost contact with a system called Dallas Isla. This was before the local flow streams were as extensively mapped as they are now. The flow stream to Dallas Isla was apparently already collapsing when it was first colonized. It just took a couple hundred years to close entirely. Now, as it happens, the rest of the flow streams in the interdependency have been robust and mostly unchanged for the last several hundred years. This seemed to satisfy Bint, and Mars was happy this fellow hadn't noticed he didn't actually answer the question. From a distance, a low crump made it into the momentary silence of the planetarium. One of the adults in the audience started to take in a sharp breath, then stopped.
And I think that's about all the time we have for today, Marsh said. Thank you all for coming, and I hope you'll come again another time. We'd love to see you.
A day when someone isn't clearly shelling someone else only a few clicks away. He flicked up the house lights and waved goodbye to the children as the adults filed them out of the room. One of the adults looked back and mouthed the words thank you to him. Marsh smiled and waved again. Still giving tours in the middle of a war? Said someone new in the back of the planetarium. That's noble.
Stupid, but noble.
Marsh looked up, saw who it was, and smiled again.
Well, technically we are nobility, aren't we, sis?
Vrenna Claremont, in her full constable uniform, smiled back and started walking down toward her brother.
Being a noble on End is like being the richest person in a trash heap. It doesn't mean much. Especially now, when the Duke is about to get his ass handed to him and rebels are running around liberating his property. It's not a stretch to assume other nobles will find their stuff similarly liberated.
My stuff is a bunch of books in graduate housing, Marsh said. I think they'll be disappointed.
You're a professor now. You should move out of graduate housing.
I'm resident master, saves on rent.
Account's son, worried about rent, Vrenna said.
We are really unimpressive nobility. It's true. There was another crump somewhere in the distance, and it didn't sound as distant as the last one. I'm doing a really good job of not panicking right now, Marsh said.
I noticed that, said Vrenna. I mean, I wasn't going to mention it, but I noticed it.
We can't all have ice water in our veins. I don't have ice water in my veins. I just know how far away those explosions are, so I'm not going to worry about them right now.
How far away are they?
About 5 clicks. The docks, where the Duke's forces are trying to bury a contingent of the rebels under shattered cargo containers. It probably won't work. Most of the rebels are long gone from there, moving to occupy strategic resources. You and I are going in the other direction anyway.
We are?
Yes. Dad sent me to collect you.
Why?
One, because there's a war on, and although I don't expect that shelling is going to get any closer, there's no guarantee the university, including your graduate housing, isn't going to be on fire by the time the sun sets today.
That bad, Marsh said.
Vrenna nodded.
Yep. You may not remember this, but the house has a watch set on it by the Imperial Marines. If a rebel comes within a click of it, they're likely to be vaporized from space. That makes it the safest place on the surface of the planet right now. Did Dad tell that to the Duke?
You know, I think he might have skipped mentioning that to him.
Mars grinned at that.
Two, Dad wants to show you something.
What is it?
Data. Anytime you want to be less ambiguous, friend, that'd be great. He said you would know what it was and that it wouldn't be something we'd talk about out loud in public.
Oh, Mars said. Yep. Another crump.
That sounded closer, Mars said.
It wasn't, but we should leave anyway. We wait any longer, someone might take it into their heads to start taking pot shots at the skimmer.
Someone took a pot shot at the skimmer anyway, several times during the flight.
Go faster, Mars urged his sister. Anytime you want to fly a skimmer just over the city rooftops without crashing into some random chimney, you let me know, she replied.
In lieu of bothering his sister further, Mars looked out the skimmer bubble at the streets of Opole.
Most of the residential streets were untouched, with only a few glimpses of people carrying things out to their cars, as if packing for a move. The main streets, however, were clogged with cars, and several were jammed to a standstill.
That took effort. Mars suspected some drivers had disabled autodrive to take control of their cars directly, either in a panic or because they suspected the government was somehow going to disable their movement. The end result either way was that these newly independent cars were messing things up for everyone else.
And every now and then, Mars would see columns of soldiers moving along the streets, armored vehicles among them, off to secure and or liberate one strategic element of the city or another.
This isn't going to end well, Mars said to his sister.
Does it ever? She asked, banking toward the Varta, the wide river that ran through Opole.
She flew the skimmer out to the middle of it, far enough away from either bank to discourage any further pot shots. Mars suspected that technically his sister was flying the skimmer illegally. Skimmers were supposed to use automation and stick to specific air routes within the city to avoid problems with other air traffic. The middle of the Varta was not one of those routes. He also suspected that today local law enforcement had other things to worry about. Presently, the skimmer left Opole behind, and the land rose into rolling hills, the Varta meandering gently between them, suburbs and then rural villages nestled up against their inclines. A small tributary of the Varta branched off into another set of hills. Vrenna followed it, and within minutes was at the house. The house was technically Claremont Palace, named for the province district that their father had been made count of nearly 40 standard years earlier, and from which the family now took its name. There had been a previous count, whom Mars had never met, having not been born yet. He had been persuaded to give up the title by accepting an appointment to the imperial court. The story Mars had been told was that the fellow needed very little convincing. Better to be a functionary at court than a noble on a planet of exile. The previous count departed so quickly he left most of his furniture and at least a couple of pets. Cats who had been perfectly fine with the new tenants, his father had told him, so long as the food kept coming.
Come on, Vrenna said as they stepped out of the skimmer on the landing pad near the garage. Let's not keep Dad waiting.
Their father, Jamie's, Count Claremont, was in his office, watching the revolution on the wall monitor. He saw them enter and pointed to the monitor.
Look at this nonsense, he said to them.
Welcome to the revolution, Vrenna said. Jamie snorted.
It's not a revolution. The rebels are probably funded by merchant guilds who want an import tax break, or something. The Duke wouldn't allow it, or something. So the rebels will take down the Duke and install an ambitious noble in his place who will cut the tariff. It'll be rubber-stamped by the Emperor because no one out there cares what happens to end, and because they think in another 20 years we'll all just do it again.
Won't we?
Not this time.
Jamie's went to his desk, retrieved a tablet, and handed it to Mars.
We finally got it, the smoking gun, and the last bit of data I needed for the prediction model.
Mars took the tablet and started scanning through the work there.
When did this happen?
6 weeks ago. A ship called Tell Me Another One experienced a flow anomaly and then recorded a transient flow shoal consistent with my model. It's observed, recorded, verified, and tracked. Everything about it fits. Everything about it is exactly what we've been looking for. It confirms everything we've suspected about the flow.
Marsh stopped trying to scan the work, which would require hours for him to read and ingest, and looked to his father. You're sure about this?
Do you think I would tell you if I wasn't? Jamie said. Have you ever known me to be anything other than exceptionally careful about this hypothesis? Do you think I didn't throw everything I could at it to disprove it? Do you think I want it to be accurate?
Marsh shook his head. No, Dad.
Don't get me wrong, Marsh. I need you to read it. I need you to tell me if there's anything I'm missing, anything I've overlooked, because as much as the scientist in me is thrilled to have made this leap in understanding the physics of the flow,
as a human being, you want to be wrong, Marsh finished.
Yes, Jamie said. Yes, I very much do.
For as long as Marsh could remember, Dad had called it the family secret. His father's examination of navigation data from every ship that had ever come to end over the last four decades. Officially, Count Claremont's role for the Empire was Chief Imperial Auditor for End. He examined the data to assure that none of the ships ever deviated from the imperially approved trade route, and thereby avoided the trade tariffs and other taxes that were required of them that were often planned years or even decades in advance. In this, the Count was one of dozens of chief imperial auditors, one in every system, who made sure money stayed where it was supposed to stay. In the pocket of the Emperor first, Guild second, and everyone else somewhere rather further down the line. In reality, Jamie's, Count Claremont, didn't give a shit about any of that nonsense. He performed the role of chief imperial auditor well enough, primarily by delegating it to underlings with the admonition that any graft too obvious to be ignored would have to be punished. But that wasn't why he came to End, or why his friend, the Emperor Ottavio VI, had sent him. He had been sent to examine the navigational data of the ships for discrepancies, but not of trade. He was looking for data that backed up his hypothesis, first formulated while he was still an undergraduate at the University of Hubfall, that the flow streams that defined the interdependency did not benefit from robustness through resonance, the theory that the unusual density and interaction of flow streams within the interdependency helped to create a stable waveform within the flow that would keep those streams open and unchanging for millennia. Jamie's read the math behind the theory and surmised what others didn't, or did and preferred not to believe, that robustness through resonance was data-fudging nonsense, and that the collapse of the flow streams to Earth and Dallas Isla were precursors rather than the exceptions that modern flow theory held them out to be. He said as much to his friend Batron, the newly crowned Emperor Ottavio VI, showed him the data, and warned him that a collapse could happen within the century. Batron saw the possibility of validity in the data. He also recognized that it represented a threat to the trade and stability of the interdependency and would likely be considered blasphemy by the Church. So he did two things for his friend Jamie's. First, he bribed him into silence by making him a count. Then he sent him to End, as far as he could be sent in the whole of the interdependency, and gave him a job that would give him the data he needed to verify or dismiss his hypothesis, and told him to tell no one but him about the work. Which Jamie's did, mostly. First, he told his wife, Guise, and then, after their twin children, Mars and Vrenna, were old enough, told them, too. He assumed the Emperor wouldn't mind. Guise took the secret to her tragic early grave. Vrenna kept the secret because she was good at secrets. Marsh kept it because once he showed enough interest and aptitude in the physics of the flow, Jamie's relied on him to check his work. Now, all the years of quiet, methodical data collection and interpretation had paid off. Jamie's, Count Claremont, had verified the most important discovery in human experience since the discovery of the flow itself. If it were known to other scientists, they'd shovel every single possible award they offered onto him. That is, if the interdependency were still around for them to do so. So it's true then, Vrenna said to her father and brother. The flow is collapsing.
The flow is the flow, Jamie said. It doesn't do anything. Our access to it, on the other hand, is definitely going away.
The unusual stability of the flow streams that have allowed the development of the interdependency is coming to an end. One by one, the streams are going to dry up. One by one, the systems of the interdependency are going to find themselves alone, for a long time, possibly forever.
How long do we have? Vrenna asked.
10 years, Marsh said, at the outside. He glanced over to his father. If Dad's models are perfectly accurate, less than that. Probably closer to 7 or 8 years before all the local flow streams are gone. Most of them will be gone before then.
Jamie's turned toward his son. And that's why you must go.
Wait, what? Marsh said.
You have to go, Jamie's repeated.
Where?
To Hub, of course. You have to take this data to the Emperor.
I thought you were sending regular updates to the Emperor, Vrenna said to her father.
I have been, obviously. The data is encrypted and sent monthly via outgoing ships.
So send this the same way, Marsh said.
Jamie shook his head. You don't understand. It's one thing to keep the Emperor updated when I'm just crunching through the data and refining the model. It's another thing entirely when the model is verified, and real, and a threat to the interdependency. He's going to need someone to walk him through it all, and then walk everyone else through it. And then argue with everyone, from scientists to politicians who want to poke holes in it for their own purposes. Someone needs to go.
I agree, Marsh said, and that person should be you.
Jamie's opened his mouth, but then Dong Zavos, the Count's secretary, poked his head into the room.
My lord, Lord Greni Nohamapitan is here to see you. He says he comes at the request of the Duke.
Bring him, Jamie said, and looked at his children.
Should we go? Vrenna asked.
I'd rather you stayed. Jamie's gestured at the monitor spilling out the news of the revolution.
It switched itself off. Jamie sat at his desk and encouraged his children to sit as well. They did.
Lord Greni Nohamapitan entered the room, clad in black, and Mars watched as the noble went out to greet his father. Greni and the Claremont siblings were of an age, but the two of them had never socialized extensively with the Nohamapitan scion. He'd arrived to End only a few years prior to handle his house's interests. They'd seen him once or twice at functions at the Duke's palace, and had once been formally introduced to him. Marsh recalled Greni scanning the both of them quickly to see if there was any political advantage in knowing either, and when the apparent answer was no, politely ignoring them from there on out. Marsh was still mildly annoyed by this. Vrenna found it amusing, because of course she would.
Count Clermont, Greni Nohamapitan said, bowing.
Lord Greni, Jamie said. A pleasure. He gestured toward Marsh and Vrenna, who stood. You remember my children, no doubt.
Of course. Lord Mars, Lady Vrenna.
Greni gave a head nod to each, which they returned before sitting again. Formalities thus satisfied, he turned his attention back to their father.
My lord, my duke has sent me on a mission of some delicacy, and I wonder if it might be better if we spoke alone.
My children are my foremost advisors, and I don't keep secrets from them. You may speak to me in front of them with the same assurance of confidentiality as you would if we spoke alone.
Greni paused for a moment, and Mars was certain he was going to insist on speaking alone with their father. He glanced over at Vrenna, who had a wry smile on her face. Then he nodded.
Yes, very well.
What is your business, Lord Greni?
As you are no doubt aware, the Duke is facing a serious challenge with the rebels.
Vrenna snorted at this. You mean to say he's on the verge of losing his dukedom, my lord, she said.
The Duke is somewhat more optimistic than your daughter, Greni said to Jamie's. Nevertheless, the challenge is real, and the Duke is now looking for ways to increase his tactical advantages.
Such as?
Weapons, my lord.
I have an antique bolt thrower left here by the previous count, Jamie's said, and I believe Vrenna carries a sidearm at all times. Other than that, I don't believe we have any weapons.
The Duke is aware that you don't have any weapons, my lord, but you do have money.
Not really. The title Count of Claremont comes with remarkably little rentable land and no local or larger monopolies. It's largely a courtesy title. I have my salary as chief auditor and an upkeep allowance for the palace. I recently sold some properties, but it's still not a lot.
Greni laughed.
Not your money, my lord. The Emperor's.
We want to use it to buy the weapons the Duke needs.
Jamie's expression darkened at this. Explain yourself, sir.
The Duke is aware that, in your role as chief auditor, all imperial taxes and levies run through your office before they are sent forward to the treasury at Xi'an.
My office doesn't send them forward. That's the role of the chief of the imperial bank here on end.
Of course. And we have spoken to Chief Han, and she is willing to assist the Duke in this endeavor. Chief Han also informed us that any transfer of imperial taxes or levies outside of their usual route to Xi'an must also be approved by your office.
That's correct, but simplistically presented. I may approve direct application of taxes and levies to imperially approved projects, like construction or infrastructure, things that those taxes would go to anyway. That saves time rather than sending the money away and then bringing it back.
Yes. And if you consult your records, you'll see that 2 years ago, when this current uprising began, the Duke asked for, and the Imperial Parliament approved, funding for the purchase of weapons to help suppress the uprising.
I don't need to consult the records, Lord Grenny, to be aware that the funds for those purchases were already allocated and the weapons purchased and shipped.
Then you're also no doubt aware that the ship carrying those weapons, the Tell Me Another One, was attacked by pirates and boarded when it came out of the flow. Its captain and crew fought valiantly to repel the attack, but in the end, many of the crew died, including the executive officer, security officer, and the owner's representative, and the ship's cargo was taken. The Tell Me barely limped into port intact.
I'm aware of the Tell Me, Jamie said.
The point is that the weapons are now in the hands of pirates. Pirates who intended to sell them to the rebels, but who can be persuaded to sell them to the Duke.
That's what the Duke's own treasury is for, Mars pointed out.
Alas, Lord Mars, 2 years of fighting have depleted the Duke's treasury and also made it more difficult to collect taxes and other revenues. He needs help.
He got the help, Vrenna pointed out. The Parliament authorized the weapons, but it's also the Duke's responsibility to patrol the space between the flow shoal and the planet. If pirates are operating there, it's because the Duke hasn't been doing his job.
Grenny turned his attention back to the Count. The Duke is aware that asking for this disbursement is unusual. His argument, and I think it's a good one, is that Parliament intended those weapons for the Duke, and therefore, in allowing these additional funds to go to the Duke to repurchase the weapons, you are following their intent.
I don't think that argument is as good as the Duke thinks it is, Jamie said, as I'm also aware that the Imperial garrison here has been told not to intervene in the matter.
This got a nod from Grenny. The Duke knows full well that the only noble currently under the protection of the Imperial military is you, Count Clermont. He finds that interesting.
It's not interesting at all, Lord Grenny. As you've noted, the Interdependency's money goes through my offices. The Emperor values his money, which is why I'm not convinced he will be happy to see it unexpectedly diverted, nor would he be happy with me.
The Duke is prepared for that eventuality.
That's nice, Jamie said, considering he will not be the one sent to prison for it.
Come now, Count Clermont. Give the Duke credit for some intelligence. Remember that we are 9 months away from Hub and Xi'an. In those 9 months, the Duke can crush this rebellion and return, with interest, any funds lent to him. He will lend his authority to yours to argue to the Emperor that you and Chief Han were acting in the best interests of the Interdependency. And in the meantime, the Duke promises that your loyalty will be rewarded.
Jamie's laughed at this. There is irony in attempting to bribe someone who you are trying to get money from, Lord Grenny.
The Duke believes that money is not the only coin for loyalty.
And Chief Han was convinced by this argument.
Yes, she was, my lord.
So, to sum up, Jamie said, you wish me to illegally transfer imperial funds to the Duke so he may buy the weapons he already bought but lost due to negligence because the person whom you have already suborned cannot do it herself. And to compensate for executing several crimes against the imperial state, you offer me nebulous so-called rewards to be determined later, which are not actual money. Is this correct?
I wouldn't put it that way, Granny said. Nor would the Duke.
Of course you wouldn't put it that way, but that's what you're asking for.
So this means you're unwilling to help the Duke, Nahama Piton said.
I didn't say that, Jamie said, and Mars, for one, was entirely surprised.
A quick glance over to his sister found her unreadable.
I may help the Duke, but I don't want either you or I, or the Duke, for that matter, to pretend that we're doing anything other than this.
Jamie stood, signaling the interview was over. Mars and Brenna stood as well. Nahama Peaton picked up the hint and bowed.
What may I tell the Duke? He asked.
You may tell him that I will have an answer for him in a week, Jamie said.
With all due respect, my lord, right now, a week is a very long time.
Not as long as the 50 years I'll spend in prison if this all goes sideways, Lord Grenny, Jamie said. That is, if the Emperor doesn't simply decide to have me killed.
May I humbly ask that I can say to the Duke that he'll have an answer within 5 days. 5 days, I am sure, would be acceptable to him.
Jamie's appeared to think about this.
Very well, Lord Grenny. 5 days.
Thank you, my lord. He bowed. If the Duke wishes to come see you himself, where may I tell him you will be these next few days?
I'll be here, Jamie said, as I always am, as I always have been.
Granny bowed again, turned, and exited. Mars waited until Vrenna went and closed the office door behind him before speaking.
You can't seriously be thinking of doing that, he said to his father.
Why not? Jamie's asked. Mars was godsmacked.
You're buying time, Vrenna said, coming back up to both of them.
I am, Jamie's agreed.
Buying time for what?
Until it doesn't matter anymore.
Jamie's pointed at the tablet that Mars was still holding.
I've modeled the collapse of the flow stream, son. It will be years before they're all gone. But some of them are already about to fail.
He tapped the tablet.
One of the first will be the stream from here to Hub. The model shows it's already collapsing.
How long until it's gone? Vrenna asked.
Another year? But it's collapsing from the entrance shoal. The best case scenario has it closing in a month. The worst case is in about a week. After that, it will be entirely inaccessible. Any ship that's here at end will stay here forever.
Jamie's turned to his son.
Which is another reason you have to go now. If you don't go now, you'll never be able to go.
You should be the one to go, Mars repeated to his father.
Jamie shook his head.
The Duke's about to be deposed. All the sitting nobles are being watched to see if they're trying to abandon the planet ahead of his fall. And now I have to give Granny Nahama Peaton an answer about the money. If I so much as leave this house, the assumption will be that I'm making a run for it. They're watching me. They're not watching you.
It makes sense, Mars, Vrenna said. You're the only one who can explain this stuff as well as Dad can, and they won't be paying attention to you.
Especially since I've made Vrenna my heir, Jamie said.
What? Mars said.
Yeah, what? Vrenna said. I officially made Vrenna my heir as soon as I knew about the collapse of the flow, Jamie said to his son. And now you have a public excuse to leave End because you won't inherit. Even right now, no one would question it.
I don't want to be a countess, Vrenna protested, and I sure as hell don't want to be imperial auditor.
Relax, Jamie said. There will be nothing to audit soon.
That's not encouraging.
Jamie smiled at his daughter and looked back to his son.
I sold some holdings recently. It should be enough to get you passage on a ship and get you set up at Hub when you get there.
How much is it? Mars asked.
About 80 million marks.
Good lord!
Yes, agreed Jamie's. I may have lied to that Granny Nahama Peaton character about my net worth. The point is, Mars, now you have means, motive, and opportunity to leave End. Leave. Do it now. Tell the Emperor what we know. If we're lucky, he may still have time to prepare.
Prepare for what?
The collapsing empire, Jamie's said, and the darkness that follows.
Chapter 5. Kiva Lagos didn't get a miracle, but as far as she was concerned, over the next week she got the next best thing,
Sivuren donor.
He's one of our franchisees, Gazan Magnut said, speaking of the pompous-looking man currently loitering on the floor of the hold the Yes Sir was operating out of in the Imperial Station. The franchisee was standing by a stack of haverfruit crates, the fruit inside of which had now come close to peak ripeness. The entire hold was saturated with a heavy floral scent that in the next few days would rapidly descend into rancidity. Magnut and Lagos were in a spare office given over by the station to the hold's current occupants. They were staring down at the poor bastard.
Okay, Kiva said. So fucking what?
He wants to buy passage for himself and his family. On the Yes Sir.
Off of End? To where?
He said that he would figure that out later.
Kiva snorted at this. It's not like there's anywhere in the interdependency that isn't already maxed out in population. They haven't built a new outpost or dug out a new city in decades.
I pointed that out to him. He said that would be his problem.
Kiva looked at the man again.
We're not running a cruise line here, Gazan.
No, ma'am, Magnut agreed. But if I may say so, it wouldn't really do us any harm, either. We're not running a full crew at this point, and we're not recruiting as many new crew as I'd like here on End. If nothing else, we can put him and his family on custodial detail and make them pay for the privilege.
Why are you having trouble hiring?
Gazan shrugged. There's a war on.
Kiva pointed. He wants to leave.
It's not the same, ma'am. He wants to leave forever and take his family with him. Everyone who has family here wants to be with them right now. Down on the surface, there are huge numbers of people moving away from the open war zones. There's a refugee crisis down there. Honestly, even if we hadn't been barred from selling the haverfruit, we wouldn't have sold much anyway. There's almost no market right now.
We still would have had our license fees and profits, Kiva noted.
Then she stopped, looked again at the man in her hold.
What's this dude's name again?
She asked Gazan.
Sivuren Donor.
Has he been a good franchisee for us?
One of our most successful. It's one of the reasons why he's asking. I think he thinks we owe him.
Does he? Kiva said.
Then I guess you better bring him up.
Gazan nodded and went to retrieve him.
Close up, Sivuren Donor was middle-aged, a little puffy, and had a look on his face that twitched between arrogance and anxiety so quickly that Kiva was certain he wasn't aware his head was doing that. It was a look of someone who, until the last few days, was pretty sure he could ride out whatever nonsense this rebellion was about, and then suddenly realized he couldn't.
Lady Kiva, Donor said, bowing. He looked at the seat Gazan Magnut had recently vacated in order to retrieve him. He clearly expected that he would be offered a seat, this meeting being between equals and all.
You want off End, Kiva said, not offering the seat.
Magnut, who stood in the corner of the room, also not taking the seat, raised his eyebrows ever so slightly at the intentional breach of courtesy.
Yes, ma'am.
Kiva nodded in the direction of Magnut. Gazan here tells me that you're one of our most successful franchisees. Donor smiled and nodded.
I have done well for your family, Lady Kiva.
Define well for me.
For this current payment period, House of Lagos received 4 million marks from my companies.
Will receive, once the current unpleasantness you are having with the Duke of End is resolved.
4 million marks, Kiva said. That's not bad. That's not bad at all.
Thank you, ma'am.
So why the fuck would I want to mess with that?
Donor blinked.
Ma'am? You're one of my biggest moneymakers. If you leave End, that money dries up.
Logic dictates I tell you to go back to your orchards and factories and keep at it.
Ma'am, there's a war on.
And?
My people here tell me you idiots do this shit on a regular basis. In a few months, you'll all be back to life as usual.
Not this time, ma'am. This one is different. The Duke is about to be overthrown. People who are known to be in his favor are being targeted and killed. They and their families.
And I suppose you are best friends with the Duke, aren't you?
I am frequently at court, ma'am. As is my wife, who is especially close to the Duchess. We have had them to our estate on occasion.
Kiva squinted. But you're not noble yourself.
No, ma'am. Donner shrugged. There was some talk of knighting me this year. My wife and I made a considerable donation to the Duke's hospital charity. But such things are up in the air right now.
Uh-huh. Kiva looked this fearful little social climber up and down and figured she had his number all right.
4 million. Excuse me, ma'am?
You're not just asking me for passage, Donner. You're also asking me to let you out of your franchise deal with the House of Lagos, to abandon our income on this planet.
Fine. That'll cost you 4 million marks. I have reached an agreement with my senior vice president to continue operations, Domer stammered.
Kiva cut him off.
Our agreement is with you, Donner. With my companies, ma'am. They're not your companies anymore, Kiva said, cutting him off again. You're getting your ass out of town. We never made an agreement with whoever the fuck this senior vice president is. We don't know if they're competent to find their asshole with a flashlight and a map. We, the House of Lagos, are going to have to vet your company again. We are going to have to assess whether this vice president is worth doing business with. If he's not, we are going to have to pull the franchise, which will inevitably lead to a bunch of legal stupidity and this asshole suing us, and then we are going to lose money because of it.
Lady Kiva, I can assure you, you can't assure me of a goddamn thing, Donner. Not anymore. You're already off the playing board. You're literally fucking useless to me right now. The only assurance here is money. A lot of it. In this case, 4 million marks. In cash, on the proverbial goddamned barrelhead. That's the deal.
It was interesting to watch color drain out of someone's face. Kiva had read about it in books, but had never seen it happen in real life until now. Donner's face went from ruddy and sweaty to pale and clammy.
I'm not sure I have that, ma'am, he said.
Oh, I am entirely certain that you do, Kiva replied. You were planning to leave the planet and never come back. You're going to have to start somewhere else, where you have no franchise and no assurance of having prospects. The only way you and your family will survive long enough to generate those prospects is with a heaping pile of ready cash.
She stopped and considered Donner.
I'm going to guess you've probably got 10 or 15 million marks in a personal data crypt right now. She pointed. It might even be in that vest pocket right there. Am I wrong?
Donner said nothing to this.
Kiva nodded.
Then back to business. 4 million to let you out of your franchise obligations.
Yes, Lady Kiva. Donner bowed, signaling that he assumed the deal had been struck.
We're not done, Kiva said. How many people are you bringing with you?
Myself, my wife, and our children.
My wife's mother?
2 servants.
How many children?
3. 2 girls and a boy.
What a nice family. 500,000 marks for each person we transport.
Kiva watched the color march back into Donor's face.
That's outrageous, he finally managed to sputter.
Probably, Kiva admitted. But I don't care. Your little family unit will be with us for 9 months while we travel to Hub. That's 9 months of food, of oxygen, of space on our ship.
That's another 4 million marks. Your math skills are impressive, Donner. I can't afford it.
Oh, well.
Surely we can come to some accommodation, my lady.
Kiva laughed.
I'm sorry. Did you think this was a negotiation?
It's not. You want off the planet, these are my rates. If you don't like them, you're welcome to look elsewhere. I understand that Tell Me Another One is departing soon.
Actually, ma'am, it's been detained, Magnoot said.
The Duke had its captain arrested. He seems to think she allowed pirates to board the ship and take a shipment of weapons.
Is that so?
Apparently the deal was originally with the executive officer who attempted